just an amount of things. But I guess we're going to... Brett, do you guys want to take a couple minutes right now? Or?
Yeah, she's going to grab a little thing to read, and then it'll be...
Okay.
Did you get it?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Rita Simpson, and I'm here on behalf of the My Case project currently underway at the U of M's English Language Institute, or the ELI. The ELI is located in the Nubbs Building, and it's a center that focuses not only on teaching, but also on research in the area of English as a second language. My Case stands for Michigan Corpus of Academic Spoken English, and a corpus is simply a collection of words. As an initial goal, we're hoping to build My Case to the size of 1 million words, or about 100 to 150 hours. Eventually, we hope that the collection of linguistic data available in My Case will help us to observe patterns of language, patterns which will aid us in developing better tools for the teaching of English as a second language. In keeping with these goals, we're interested in patterns which are observable across the speech of different groups of people. We're not at all interested in any one individual's speech. We're not interested in correct or proper speech, but rather in natural speech as it is really spoken here at the university. We're not at all interested in individual teaching styles or in the content of any particular class. Our presence here is in no way a method of evaluation of this class. We are simply here in order to gather linguistic data for My Case. My Case has been approved by the Institutional Review Board, and we have received the consent of your GSI to audio tape this class today for the purposes which I just explained. If any of you have any objections and do not wish to be audio taped, I would like at this time to give you the opportunity to object. Okay, by your silence, I'm assuming your consent, and I thank you for your attention. Should any of you decide after the class is over to withdraw your consent, please do not hesitate to let me know after class, or by email, which I'll leave with your GSI. Thank you very much. If you have any questions about any of this information, you can ask any one of us.
And should we direct our speech towards the microphone?
These microphones will pick up everything, and should just pretend they're not here. And I'm going to sit in the back there and just take notes and listen.
Okay. Great. Okay, we've got two options today. One of them is we could go over Kant, the transcendental argument. The second one is I had originally prepared a review of the whole semester comparing the epistemology and metaphysics of all the figures. My section yesterday opted to talk about Kant and sort of coaxed me into having a review session next week on Wednesday at 11. So I'm going to be doing the sort of review of all the figures at that point. If you guys wanted to come to that, you could. Or we could do it today. So
where is the review session?
11 o'clock, and it's going to be 2402. I mean, sorry, that's this. 11 o'clock Wednesday. It's 2440. Mason Hall. I'm not sure what the date is on that, but next Wednesday.
When's the final?
The final is the following Tuesday.
It's April
22nd. It's
the 22nd? The 22nd? All right. So how many people would want to talk about Kant today? Great, that's what we'll do. So you guys are welcome to come to this to talk about the other part. So the main thing that we covered is the transcendental arguments in the last two lectures. And we've covered four of them. So the key first thing to do is understand the style of a transcendental argument, or what it is. And so this handout explains what it is for starters. And you guys might remember from a couple of times ago when we talked about you, that we talked about the design argument. And we said you could think of it as an inference to the best explanation. So what you have in the inference to the best explanation is a kind of phenomenon or fact that you want to explain. And then what you do is adduce several different possible explanations for it. So we talked about God being a possible explanation for the design in the world or the order in the world. And then And then I think it was in response to Eve, she said, well, you know, aren't there other possible explanations like evolution? Or another one, evolution and God. And that's true. There are always several possible explanations of any phenomenon that you're going to try to use in an inference to the best explanation. So what happens is, in the form of one of these arguments, you take this phenomenon as your premise and then try to argue towards one of these particular explanations in your conclusion. So like in the original form of this argument, this is kind of actually an interesting historical fact. The first time this came up, these guys were not even on the board. The only other possible explanation was chance. And this was in the 1800s when Paley gave the argument. So what Paley did was say, look at this amazing design, two ways to explain it, God and chance. I want to show you that God is really the only explanation that's going to do a good job of explaining design. Because chance alone could never produce the sort of methodical patterns that you see in the world and the laws of nature. So what Paley did was just ignore these guys for a moment, these evolution ones. Paley said, chance can't do it. There's only two possible explanations, God or chance, so there must be a God, given this phenomenon that we know about. So that's a standard inference to the best explanation form. Questions about that? Okay, great. So basically, a transcendental argument is just a fancy name for an inference to the best explanation. And so what we have on the handout there are sort of several obvious facts. So take the second one, unified consciousness. And the idea is, Kant says, look, it's an obvious fact that we have a unified consciousness, by which he means it's obvious that Janine's thought states and beliefs and desires and mental states all kind of hang together in a unified way inside of her, in the same way that Marx's kind of hang together inside of him. And Marx's perception of the board and my perception of the board are sort of in two separate unified consciousnesses. We're not the conscious nine. We're not at all tempted to think that we have, that your space and my space are unified. So he wants to explain how it is that we just have a single unified consciousness. And he says, look, you know, sure there are several different possible explanations for this. Jen, thanks. So you've got Locke trying to do it with memory, right? And you've got Hume trying to do it, and even explicitly saying out loud that he failed to do it with his causal connection theory. Remember his sort of explanation at the end of the treatise where he said, sorry, I guess I wasn't able to really present to you the unity of consciousness. You've got Descartes trying to do it with the soul theory. And basically, we all have already walked through the whole idea that each of these ones failed, right? And Kant says, look, I'm going to offer you a new explanation, one which involves the categories of the understanding. And it's the best explanation that we have for our unified consciousness. In fact, it's the only adequate explanation. So we know the categories of the understanding exist. So see the similar structure. You're trying to get to the existence of something. In a design case, you're trying to get to the existence of God. In Kant's case, you're trying to get to the existence of the categories. So do you guys see the structures here? Making sense? Okay. So somebody explain to me how it is that the categories explain unified consciousness. It involved a game.
An object?
Yep. Okay, the categories are like rules. of the understanding. And here's kind of the analogy. So you're supposed to think about, just think of a Monopoly board and think of moves being made on the board, right? And to an alien who's just kind of watching these moves made on the board, it looks a little random, sort of like there's nothing hanging together about the activity on the board except for that is all happening on the board. But it's just sort of like moving six spaces this way and moving three spaces that way. Who knows why people are doing it? But once a person who's played Monopoly or knows the rules of Monopoly looks at the board and sees what's happening, there's sort of a unified thing happening on the board. The rules unify the game. So, and it might sound a little far-fetched, but actually think about it. Like, when you're playing a game, rules really do constitute it. Because, like, for example, if when you rolled the dice, you started playing Twister on the Monopoly board instead. Like, you roll them and you get a six, and then you think, okay, that means I gotta put my big toe on Park Place, and then you roll it again, and it means you gotta put your pinky on, you know, jail, or something like that. You're playing a whole different game, right? So, and that's just in virtue of having changed the rules. So the rules actually constitute and make up the game, or unify it. So in the same way, there's supposed to be an analogy here where the rules, or the categories of the understanding, our rules unify our consciousness.
What is meant by rules of understanding?
Right. That's a really great question. Okay, so remember back to last week in the Play-Doh machine? She had our cognitive faculties, and there were a couple kinds, right? There's the human sensibility. And the human understanding.
We never got to it.
Huh?
We never got to the human understanding.
Right, well that's actually what we're getting to today. But there's the outer sense and the inner sense. And the outer sense was kind of like sense perception. And what it did was impose or squish the Play-Doh into a spatial framework. And then remember, the inner sense was kind of like introspection. And what it did was impose a temporal framework. And then, as Jen said, we never quite got over here to that understanding. But, what there are, in the same way that there's two kinds of human sensibility, two species of it, there's 12 kinds of human understanding, which are called 12 categories of understanding. So, in effect, what Kant is trying to do in this transcendental argument is prove to you the existence of this set of cognitive faculties. So make that connection, because I think that might not have been clear. So he's really trying to show something about our psychology with this argument. These categories, the most important of them for us are substance and causation. And Jen's question is, well, so how is that a rule, right? How does this category constitute a way of unifying or a rule for our mind? Here's my best way of explaining it. Remember when we had the dough, which was like the noumena, and then we said, basically, you process it through the human sensibilities, and it comes out, whoops, that's like a fun factory, sorry, fun factory over on this side, sensibilities over here, and it came out all shaped up, right? I think it was like a spaghetti shape. That was the one that Mark chose, I think. And then over here, what you get is a sense datum. I'm really using that word roughly, but it connects it to stuff, which is shaped in terms of time and space. Okay? So you see something, well, you've got the noumena and you're trying to connect to it, and as you try to connect to it, it gets shaped in time and space. So I start seeing things in succession. and I start seeing things at particular places in relationship to each other. Then comes the human understanding. And in a way, you can think of it as further processing the already processed noumena. So what you end up with is sort of processed noumena, right? Which is noumena that not only is shaped in terms of time and space, but now is going to be shaped according to one or more of these categories. So now, if we just focus for a second on the category of cause, I've got this noumena, I'm seeing everything in terms of time and space, and now the category of cause is going to help me shape it further. And so when I push this and see it roll, instead of just thinking of that in the way that Hume did as a constant conjunction of events, namely in terms of my pushing being a cause and the rolling being an effect, I construe it in terms of a causal relationship where my pushing is a cause and actually makes the effect occur. So in a way, I'm imposing a way of understanding my sense datum by using the category of causation when I see that thing and say, hey, I just caused it to roll. Yeah, Elton.
Okay, my question is, how do we know that the noumena does not already have these processes already involved? Like, could it have a spatial framework, a temporal framework, but since we're using our sensibilities, the fun factor, if you will, we're assuming that that is causing those things to be in there where they could actually be in it already. How do we know that? It's our
contribution.
Yes.
This is the question that even everybody's asking last week. And the main way we're supposed to know that is just by being convinced by these arguments that it's us, okay? That the best explanation is the categories. That's not really convincing, because what you're going to say is something like...
Wouldn't it be simpler just to say that noumena already has that? I mean, wouldn't Arkham's razor say the simplest explanation is the best one? So you could just say that the simplest explanation is not that we add something to it that already has it.
I see where you're going. I think it's a really good point to press on.
Too bad he's dead.
Pardon?
Too bad he's dead.
It is, actually, because I think a lot of people have a lot of questions for this thing.
Mail bomb.
I mean, one thing to start thinking about is that we know that in several cases we are contributing something.
In
terms of, like, say, bent sticks in water, right? We know that the stick isn't really bent and that we're seeing it as bent because we straighten things, or
the temporal framework
perception.
If you were blindfolded and you had your hearing, like, stopped, and you're, like, locked in a dark box, people lose all sense of time real quickly when they're deprived of outside sensory information. So wouldn't that indicate that something on the outside, or not the inner sense as he calls it, would contribute to our temporal framework?
Mm.
Another thing is, you're talking about the bent stick. We know the stick isn't bent.
Because when we pull it out.
But I mean, when you see the bent stick, we kind of, you know.
Well, anybody who's gotten scared.
We might be
fishing.
Imposing it.
Well, this is just an example. It's true, there are ways that we figure out that it was straight. But it's an example of the ways that we do contribute. And all I'm saying is kind of takes that sense of we definitely contribute something. We all know we contribute something and tries to order exactly what it is we contribute. But I know this isn't a totally satisfactory way to respond. Yeah.
I don't understand what you mean by imposing a temporal framework.
All right. Well, temporal framework, for starters, is going to be seeing things in terms of before and after, or in terms of succession. So a lot of people want to say that God, for instance, is not in any temporal framework whatsoever and is in some sort of eternal map, right? In which, whatever you were, you know, like, let's say you had Cheerios for breakfast and now you're here, somehow you're eating Cheerios and your being here is happening all at the same time. Because there's no time. I mean, there's no way to talk about this easily. But the idea is, for us, it's really hard to wrap your head around what that could possibly mean. To say every single event happens at once, right? And Kant is trying to say, that's just, I mean, the difficulty we have with doing that is just testimony to the fact that we see everything in terms of succession and before and after at just the word go. Like, we don't know how to think of things any other way. And so that's, he would say, our inner sense at work in ordering our experience. Does that help?
Yeah, but it just seems that if we can't think of it in any other way, then why do we assume, it seems like we're getting back to the same question. I mean, how can he even say that we impose it if he himself can't even think of it in any other way? Like, we can't understand how it could not be the way we think it is. How we think, you know, you just crossed your legs after I started talking, you know what I mean? But I guess I don't understand how we could have imposed that on the
right.
world. How
you guys are you're good to press on this. I mean, so for example, what you're doing is saying, well, this is the second one on your handout, but there's this other one, which is an argument from synthetic a priori truths in geometry to the existence of the human sensibilities, which include the inner sense, which imposes space and imposes time on it. And what you guys are saying is, but look, I mean, isn't there another good explanation of this, which is the existence of time and space, right? Am I hearing you guys right? So then what you're doing is playing Kant at his own game in a way. You're saying, look, I'll agree with you that we've got some kind of thing that needs explanation here, namely the fact that every time we think of things, we think of them in terms of time. Every time we see things, we kind of put them in space. But we're not ready to just assume it's the human sensibilities which are responsible for this fact that we both agree on. We think actually there's a better explanation, which is the actual existence of the temporal framework and the spatial framework, which you're saying we impose, maybe really out there. And so basically, I don't know what Kant's reply would be exactly. But you're trying to say, that's not the one, this is the one. And Kant is trying to say, that's not the one, this is the one.
But it just seems like he doesn't even take, it seems like actually saying that time and space exists is sort of the most natural first assumption that you would make. Whether it be true or not, it just seems that, I think as humans, we naturally tend to think that if something seems like it's out there, our first guess is to say it exists.
Right.
It seems like he doesn't even take that into consideration. It's like his first thought is we must impose it, and then he just says that's better than the rest, and it seems like, well, how can you even claim to have thought this out or have done anything good here if you ignored the most obvious first thought?
You
want to
try to respond, Mike?
Something that strikes me as strange is in context with the rest of the people is that there's a lot of skepticism about whether the real world exists. Now, I was wondering maybe if that's where he gets the idea of, you know, that's why existence in time and space isn't a real possibility because all the skepticism. But the thing is, if that was true, then he still does believe in the existence of the real world.
Because
so
he
like,
believes in the existence of the noumena.
Yeah.
Or?
The dough.
Right, that's the noumena.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of like the one argument, it seems that he would be able to use to justify crossing out existence of time and space. He still holds on to the fact that there is a real dough out there or something, the noumena.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that part really kind of confuses me, because
otherwise
it seems like the only explanation of how to cross out the existence of time and space.
I was just going to ask, going back to the whole, like, why everything's blue, we assume, though, that it's not just us imposing the blue, but the world's actually blue.
Mm-hmm.
Can you maybe explain that? Because maybe that would help if we saw a negative light.
Right. Well, so the blue one, I mean, I was thinking about that this morning because I thought, you guys have such great questions that I never know the answers. Okay. One thing about the blue example is you're probably just not going to be able to get it off the ground because we're not all going to agree that that's a phenomenon to be explained. Right? So you'd have to be able to put it up here in your premise, and your premise is supposed to be something that says, you know, okay, it's obviously true that everything is blue, right? And people are just not going to go, yeah. So that's, I mean, I know that your example was not meant to be sort of something we would all agree to, but I'm saying, in a way, that feature of the argument is so critical that the example doesn't really fly unless it is. because the features, that's one of the main aspects of what Kant was trying to do, is pick out something that we'll all agree to in the premise and say, that's a fact. And we're curious about why it's like that. And get us curious enough and knock out enough other explanations, which he did, I think, more successfully in the second argument than he did in the first. You know, get us enough curious so that we end up saying, well, yeah, we're open to a new explanation, and actually yours does a good job of explaining it. That help any? So that's why the blue example isn't going to work, I think. But I think the blue example is a good example of the kind of structure that's supposed to happen, which is sort of like, here's something to explain and tell me how to explain it.
This is a side issue. What are the other 10 categories to understand it?
They're in your book.
Are they?
Yeah.
We don't need to know them. Really.
I just
no,
want,
you don't need to know them, but I can tell you the page so you can
okay.
check them out.
Is it in the, which section?
I think it's the second part, but it might be the first part. Page 46. Under the transcendental table of the concepts of the understanding.
Oh, I remember those now.
Just
yep.
so you know, that's a tricky thing that you might not have picked up. The categories and the word concepts of the understanding are two ways of saying the same thing.
So they're
right?
categories, concepts, and rules.
Yes.
Now I remember that.
Yes.
Chart. Yeah.
So categories of the understanding equals concepts of the understanding equals rules of the understanding. This is one really hard part about Kant, is that you think you've got it, and then you start realizing he's identified two things and you've kept them separate. So, just if that helps any.
Can we go over the argument for human sensibility?
Sure. Okay, so that's the first argument here. Actually, if you guys have your old handout on Kant 1 through 3, get it out. If not, it's coming around right now on the left side of this yellow folder. Okay, because basically, as you can see, the first supposedly obvious premise, the one which is supposed to be as obvious as unity of consciousness or as obvious as divine in the world, whatever, is the existence of synthetic a priori knowledge, which you'll remember from the first couple of lectures was actually contestable, right? We were trying to figure out whether there was anything like that. And now Kant is assuming that there definitely is, and it's so obvious that now we can try to use that fact to explain.
Did he ever show why it was obvious?
Yeah, so that's why I'm having you look at Kant 1 through, the first handout on Kant 1 through 3. And I mean, I think he tried to do this in a couple of different ways, but I always thought this was the clearest one. So what we're doing right now is just in service of showing you why you're supposed to be convinced that P1 is obvious, okay? So, here's why you should think there are some synthetic a priori truths. And here's one about geometry. Remember what synthetic means and what a priori means for starters. Somebody remind me what's synthetic.
It actually gives you information.
Okay, good. In a way, synthetic is sort of like the garbage category. Analytic is... It's not analytic. And then so you define it that way, and then analytic means that the concept of the predicate is in the concept of the subject. Okay? So something like bachelors are unmarried is analytic because the concept of the predicate, namely unmarried, is already in the concept of bachelor, which is your subject. So it's going to be analytic truths are just true in virtue of the meaning of the word. Bachelor and unmarried. Synthetic truths are not analytic. That's basically what I think they mean. So you're going to know that something is synthetic just because you couldn't figure out whether it was true or not by looking at the meanings of the words. So something like Janine has brown hair. It's not obvious from the word Janine that I'm going to have brown hair. Or bachelors are fun. It's not obvious from the word bachelor that they're all going to turn out to be fun, even though many of them are. Right? So then basically, synthetic is going to be something that's not true in virtue of the meaning of the words, and it's going to give us information. They're the kind of exciting truths. You don't just sit around with a dictionary to create them. You have to go out and experience the world to figure them out. You synthesize something new onto the concept of the subject.
Doesn't he distinguish synthetic knowledge from experience knowledge? Or is that the same thing?
Oh, he definitely does distinguish. Okay, and this is where we get to a priori versus a posteriori. So a posteriori is knowledge from experience. And a priori is the garbage category. It's not a posteriori. Okay? Which means any way that you get knowledge except from experience.
So where would synthetic fall in both categories?
These are cross-cutting distinctions. So, right, you could, the big point of a couple times ago is to show that you could get, here's synthetic.
I meant more than that to come. I thought it was, I thought a priori wasn't just not us. A posteriori, was it was actually necessary?
No, it was actually critical that it be a garbage category to Kant. So, hold on a second. So, analytic and synthetic, this is a distinction about what makes the sentence true. And analytic is basically the relations of the concepts in the sentence. You just say the concepts make it true. And synthetic is something else makes it true. So like in the case of bachelors are fun, you might say the world makes it true, right? And Kant's gonna wanna say something about the structure of our mind makes it true. So those are just examples of things that could make it true besides the concepts. Then the distinction between a priori and a posteriori is not a distinction that's being drawn about what makes the sentence true, but how we came to know its truth, or came to know the sentence. So in a posteriori, we come to know it through experience. And a priori is we learn it some other way than experience.
I'm confused, and why does he keep making references to a priori and necessary being the same thing?
Oh, I'm sorry. I see what you mean. Yes, yes. It turns out that, well, that's a really good question. It turns out that one of the ways we can know it is through reason, and that's generally thought to be the key way. And things that you know through reason are necessary. Because the only way to know something through reason is to find out that its opposite was a contradiction. And so it itself would have to be necessary if its opposite were a contradiction. Because contradictions just can't be the case. So like if, let's say not A is a contradiction, then A has to be necessary. So if that's how you come to know the truth of the sentence in hand, then the sentence you've got is necessary. And that's why you get this kind of relationship between a priori and necessity, because the main way of doing something other than using experience to come to know something is reason, and that's going to be a necessary truth. Did that
so
make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
So is it a distinction between necessary and contingent? Is a posteriori contingent truth? Or is that oversimplified?
I'm not sure if you could know a necessary truth from experience, but I guess I wouldn't want to rule it out. In which case, I'm not sure I'm ready just to write contingent down here.
Okay.
Okay.
So if it's a priori, it is necessary, but that it doesn't mean that if it's necessary, it's necessarily a priori.
Right. And in fact, what's a little confusing about this is that I don't think every single a priori truth is gonna be necessary. Because here's an example. Remember another way that Descartes, but not Locke, but Descartes and other people think that you could come to know something without experience is innatism, right? So that you could come to know something by the fact that you were born with this thought. So what's been puzzling me is sort of like, okay, so that's another way to come to know something without using experience. You just look inside of yourself and introspect an innate belief or concept that you had. That would be a much easier way to get to a synthetic a priori truth than all the stuff that Kant is doing, if it turned out that there was a synthetic truth that you innately had, but somehow that never came up in lecture. So.
It seemed like something innate would be something synthetic, since it's something else that makes it innate, like that you've given that knowledge.
Again? Remember, this distinction is just based on what makes it true. It could, maybe it could turn out that you had an innate belief, like bachelors are unmarried. In fact, Locke thought that most people confused, well, most people thought that innate beliefs were reason, they got from reason. Remember that part? So like when they were reasoning along and they said, see, it's innate because when you use your reason, like you just remembered it, you recollected something. And the idea was supposed to be, Locke was saying, well, I could have just figured it out without having it be innate, just by using my reason. Just the fact that I used my reason didn't all of a sudden show that it was innate. These are separate ideas. So these are the distinctions. And it's a little confusing, but I think the easiest way to think about it is the way I've described, where the a priori category and the synthetic category are garbage categories. Okay?
Seems like it messes a lot of stuff up, or maybe it doesn't, but it just seems like if we've been, everything we've done since the beginning has been in reference to a priori meaning necessary. And if it doesn't have to be, then it just seems that things...
Well, here's... Here's the third thing, which is going to be, I don't know if you guys remember Lewis writing innatism up there, which is, I mean, on the board he said that there was, that innate beliefs were a priori, because they didn't come from experience. But maybe you're right. If you want to think of it in terms of necessity, I think it's okay for the purposes of this class. I just don't think it's the way Kant thought about it. Because here's one of the key things, is that Kant thought he was going to show us a third way we could come to knowledge, which was through analyzing our cognitive faculties,
right?
And that's kind of critical.
Okay, but I'm looking through my notes, and he did write, he wrote, a priori, not dependent on experience, could be reason alone or innate knowledge, and then he put distinctly Kantian, is that a priori requires necessity and is strictly universal as well. So, unless I wrote the wrong thing down, Loeb actually said that Kant had this, that the a priori didn't usually include innateness, but if for Kantian's view, it required necessity and that it was universal.
Well, doesn't he say right in the beginning that a priori knowledge, both kind, analytic, comes from the principle of contradiction, but synthetic, it isn't derived from it, but it must not violate the principle of contradiction?
Yeah, so synthetic. These ones are definitely the case. All analytic truths are going to be necessary. And synthetic truths aren't going to be necessary.
Well,
generally.
Can't
Although, violate, wait, that's not quite right about synthetic. But
can't violate the principle of contradiction, so wouldn't it be necessary then? Because if it's not allowed to violate it...
Oh, wait a minute. But nothing can really violate the principle of contradiction.
I'm probably just like, no.
What it means to violate the principle of contradiction is to have... something be both itself and not itself at the same time. And nothing in reality, at least according to an analytic philosopher, does that. Okay. But here's the important thing about analytic truths, is that their opposite would violate that principle. And that's not the case with the synthetic truth, generally. Okay. The reason I'm hedging on that is because some synthetic truths are going to be necessary. And so some of them look like their opposites would violate that. But this is getting really technical, and we don't really have to know all of this stuff in detail. And I think, Jen, maybe you're right. We should just take a priori truths to be necessary and just kind of forget about innatism for now and just say necessary and just think of two ways then for a truth to be a priori. One of them is that it's coming from reason, and the other one is that it's coming from Kant's way, which is going to be an analysis of the cognitive faculties. Okay? But recognize there's a lot of different usages of this term. Okay. Is that?
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. It just
no. I mean, I think it's good because it's too confusing. You're right. Let's just drop the idea or something. Ben.
Can I ask a really general?
Definitely.
Okay. Do you think you could discuss the difference between a human sensibility and a human understanding? Seems to me that they're kind of similar, or actually that human understanding kind of encompasses, one of the things that it would encompass is human sensibility.
Okay, good.
You could just discuss the difference.
Yeah. you're right to think there's a similarity here because both of these things are imposing frameworks on the noumena. So there's something really similar going on. But the important difference is twofold. One of them is this one, if you think about it sort of in a very naive but sort of accurate Kantian way, this one processes first, and then this one processes what that one processed. So in a sense, what happens is you've got your noumena, and it comes down and processed first by your sensibilities. You get output number one, which is a sense datum that's organized in terms of space and time. Then it's processed next by your human understanding, and you get output number two, okay, which is going to be not only processed by space and time, but also processed by the categories of understanding.
All right, so if we could just go back to the Plato for a second.
Yes.
So is Kant saying that when I sense, or so by using my my eyes, when I see the Plato, is he saying that at that point I don't understand it, and then it has to go to my understanding?
Yeah, so that's a nice way to think of it. I mean, so basically what happens is you have...
I don't understand what I just said. No, seriously.
Would this work better?
Wait, how can you possibly...
Think of it
sort of
like this.
So let's say I'm touching a fire, for example, and
okay.
I burn myself.
Yeah,
at that
yeah.
point that I burn myself, I don't understand that it hurts. Is that, I mean...
You wouldn't... Yeah, maybe that's a good way to... But that's like such a...
That,
I thought it happened more instantly than that. It's
you might know that you're like hurting yourself,
I've seen
but
something. Let my mind tell me what it means now.
You know that you're hurting yourself, but you wouldn't know the fire's hurting, you know, unless you had an understanding.
Let's
right?
take a less spicy example.
Okay, when we go back to the Plato.
Let's go to the Plato.
Okay,
if
we go back to
the
so I'm looking at the Plato and I see its color or I feel its texture.
Okay.
So at that point, when I'm using my sense perceptions, do I not understand?
You wouldn't know that it's a. Here's like a really obvious thing. You wouldn't know like that it's a building, right? Until you start organizing. Like right now, let's just say I've processed this noumena outside me, right up there. And I've used my human sensibility. And what I know is that it's like at a certain distance from me, and it's right now at that distance from me, okay? Then I'm gonna use my understanding to start putting on some more layers of concepts onto it. Building is not one of the 12 categories because it's a concept that's less universal. But just think of it as an example of something that the human understanding does at some later stage in the process of being at work on your sense datum. And then I'll say, hey, this sort of reddish-brownish object, 20-ish feet-ish from me, is a building, right? And I can't do that until I start thinking about my sense datum. And in this sense, I guess I'd always like Kant, because I feel like he's the only one who's sort of distinguishing sort of pure sense datum inputs that you might get at an earlier stage from more organized ones, which are really interpretive, right? And so in a sense, these guys are a little bit more fine or something, and these guys are really prior and really elemental and basic ways of processing. Mark and Alvin.
Okay, I've got an example maybe.
Yeah.
Like if you're playing basketball and you have like people that are on your team and people that are on the other team, like initially you process it as, okay, there's like shapes and basketball player, somebody with socks on. But when you start distinguishing it between opponent and teammate, that's something that it's not there, but that would be your understanding. When you make that distinction, but the when you view it as just like people and colors and shapes and that would be your sensibility.
No, even people, colors, and shapes are going to be the understanding because all your sensibility does is space and time. Okay.
Okay.
But you might right now be sort of showing that there's tons of different levels of interpretation which are going to happen, and think of the 12 categories as the most basic of those additional levels of interpretation beyond space and time.
Okay.
But that's good.
My example, you're like next to the biggest mountain of Plato. You have a knife with a clock on it. You cut off a chunk of the Plato, so that's like your sensibilities. That gives you a shape and a time when you did it. And you stick it in the fun factory and get the shape out, which would be your understanding, and that's what you perceive, what comes out to somebody like Plato. Would that work?
Oh, so wait, you're doing the fun factory twice then?
Yeah, in a
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, that's good, yeah. But the second time, it's a little different.
Right.
You've got a different sort of shape on it. Okay, just to really quickly finish up this thing, because I know we've got to have ELI come back up here for just a minute. Okay, so this was all an attempt to explain synthetic a priori distinctions so that we could understand why premise one of this argument was supposed to be really obvious. Just take a quick look at this argument. Think of a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. A straight line is your subject. Shortest distance between two points is your predicate. Is the predicate already in the subject?
No.
Oh, no. You guys are supposed to be no. Mike thinks it's yes. But
well, I have a problem with that in general. I mean, even does the 7 plus 5, is
yeah.
it really 12? And says that's synthetic. That, I mean, even in more basic examples, I have a lot.
Okay. Okay, yeah. So let's just assume the answer is obviously that it's not contained, okay? That it's supposed to be obvious that it's not analytic, okay? And then the other idea is, so how do you come, so it's, whoops, sorry, so it's synthetic. And then how do you come to know it? Well, you don't come to know it by just comparing bunches of little lines everywhere, right? You can figure it out by using your mind and the facts of mathematics. So you don't come to know it by experience, you come to know it in some other way, namely by reason. Okay, so then he's trying to say, look, these truths of geometry are synthetic a priori. Okay. So that's supposed to be obvious, and that's the beginning point up here. See that? And then you're supposed to be able to find out that the human sensibilities are the best way to explain this obvious fact.
But that was the part I didn't understand.
Right, I know. We only have 2 minutes, but ask me at the review, or else read through this, because it should be relatively clear. Okay?
Yeah, I read through it, that's why I asked.
Okay. We just need one more second for you guys. Come on, okay.
I just have a few of you fill out really quick speaker information sheets. And those of you who participated in the discussion. Thank you. No names.
Thank you guys.
Thanks a lot.
So I'll see you next Wednesday at 11 if you want to come, but it's not required. I really enjoyed you.
I have a question.
Yes.
How can one thing cause another? Would there have to be like a recession? If things have to come, if the thing that causes the other thing has to come before the other? Would there have to be a recession? Like, we might experience like the present,
mm-hmm.
but how could, like, isn't he trying to say that there's causation outside of our mind, that these objects are causally connected?
Well, that's debatable, actually. Especially given that causation is one of the categories of understanding. It looks like we contribute causation to the goal, not.
But if it's irreversible, how can the objects outside our mind, I think the Loeb said, objects outside our mind can't be reversible.
Yeah.
So wouldn't that be a causation outside of mind?
Well, or at least the irreversibility is, right? And what happens is causation has the same relation as irreversibility does, which is an asymmetrical sort of relation, right? And so it turns out that the stuff that we impose has a feature that the noumena has, but we can't really say that it has a particular feature of irreversibility.
Yeah.
Are you going to have office hours next week before Wednesday?
Not before Wednesday.
Monday maybe?
They do have a little microwave recipe.